Hi TYT, it's Katie Halper. I'm really excited to be talking to Asad Haider, who is a writer. He's a founding editor of Viewpoint Magazine, and he's the author of a book, brand spanking new, Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump, which I've definitely, as you can see, read. It's a great book, and you have some really provocative things to say, which is always fun. So welcome, Asad.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Hi, Katie.
Hi. So I'm going to start with a really, really hardball question, which is, why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote this book because I kept encountering a kind of impasse or deadlock on the left, which is that people treat race and class as separate and opposed problems. And there's a whole tradition of radicals in the United States who saw race and class as inseparable. And that's the kind of tradition that I encountered and was politicized by, and I think is really relevant for today. And the fact that it's forgotten in these discussions that turn it into an opposition is just a real shame. So part of the purpose of the book is to revive that.
So why and how has it been suppressed?
Well, some of the ways it's been suppressed is that organizations like, let's say, the Black Panther Party or others that came after it are represented and appropriated in a way that suppresses their class politics, in a way that leaves their class politics out. It leaves out the fact that they saw themselves as part of a global revolution against capitalism. And a lot of people who are in more privileged positions or in elite positions in the United States want to call on that kind of legitimacy on the brand name of the Black Panther Party while suppressing the threat that they pose to their elite positions and to the economic equality they benefit from.
So one of the terms that's kind of essential to this discussion is identity politics. Can you shed some light on what that means?
Yeah. Well, so I think, first of all, that when people talk about identity politics, it becomes a kind of empty term because people fill it with whatever meaning they want to bring to it and with whatever kind of political agenda they want to bring to it. And it's become a big point of discussion now following the 2016 Democratic primaries, in which, was it 2016?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, suppressed memory, king of suppression.
Yeah.
Suppressed memory, yeah.
So, I mean, Bernie Sanders came to represent class politics, economic inequality, whereas Hillary Clinton was the candidate who supposedly was the only one who cared about racial and sexual discrimination, and that got equated with identity politics. Identity politics is when you care about these other issues, and if you care about economic inequality, you probably don't care about those other issues. But that's a really ahistorical and kind of distorted way of looking at things. The origin of the term is with a group called the Combahee River Collective, which was an organization of mainly Black lesbians who were involved in various different kinds of social movements. They were involved in the feminist movement, or the women's liberation movement, as it was called at the time, the anti-war movement, the Black liberation movement, and the socialist and labor movements. And they said, look, in all of these movements, we find that our particular identity, which is really specific and has all of these different specific traits and specific forms of oppression that we're subject to, gets excluded by the single issue kind of agenda of these different organizations. So if we organize autonomously and we assert our identities, that means that we break up that kind of structure of exclusion that's holding these different movements back. It means that we make it possible to have a movement that's about the liberation of everyone. So if Black women get free, then we all get free. And that's why the recent republication of their collective statement, edited by Kianga Yamada Taylor, along with a lot of interviews with founding members, it's called How We Get Free. Right. Because it's about how everyone can get free. And what that meant for their politics was that they were always building coalitions. They were building coalitions with feminist movements for reproductive rights. They were building coalitions with striking construction workers. And now identity politics has been turned into a way that my identity makes me separate from everyone else. And that is a total reversal of what they intended.
Yeah, it's a betrayal, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I feel like the way that people who are on the kind of Hillary side of this divide, and I know we have to get beyond the primaries, but it did expose a real rift that's still there. But people who use the word identity politics in a way to criticize, let's say, the Bernie people, their definition of identity politics is like identity except for class. Or when they talk about intersectionalism, which we can talk about, intersectionality, it's intersectionality except for class. And it reminds me of this term PEP, progressive except on Palestine.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, they're you can't really be that without having the other part in it. Like, you can't actually be an intersectionalist. You can't actually be someone who embraces identity politics if you omit a large part of people's identity.
Well, I think that, you know, the Combahee River Collective proposed the term identity politics for a very specific context with a very specific goal. And there's no need to cling to it in an entirely different political context when it's been taken up to mean something that's the opposite of the political agenda that they had. So, you know, some people want to speak about a radical identity politics and, a moderate identity politics or something like that. I think we don't need the term anymore.
We don't need to reappropriate it.
Yeah, what we need is their legacy of which is one almost of disrupting identities more than it is about claiming a fixed one.
Right, because as you said, the point is coalitions, not kind of separate movements. That is a tricky balance, right? Because how do you make sure that people's needs are represented or people feel like they're spoken to in a way that doesn't fragment movements?
Yeah, well, coalitions are necessarily between different organizations. I mean, coalitions mean that you approach a group which is doing something different, which is has different goals and different means of achieving them, and you say, let's work together and let's allow ourselves to affect each other and change each other. And that's how politics really happens. I think that's the lesson of the great successful liberation movements of the 20th century.
So can you talk about the history? You just explained the origin of the term identity politics. Can you talk about the history of the left? And I guess the 2016 primary really put out the idea that socialism or leftism is the kind of exclusive domain of straight white men. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the history of racial justice and anti-racist organizing that mm-hmm. existed, for instance, in the Communist Party mm-hmm. or in other areas of the left?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's interesting to note that the Socialist Party and the Communist Party were composed, and the Industrial Workers of the World, for example, which became a big part of the Communist Party, were composed largely of immigrants.
Right.
And immigrants were slowly absorbed into this social construct, which we call whiteness, the white race. And I have a part in my book about the invention of the white race, which is the term of Theodore Allen. But the Communist Party especially came to realize that whiteness and white chauvinism, as they called it, was a major threat to organizing the working class, because it introduced a fundamental division between black workers who were super exploited, who were subject to an extremely high level exploitation because of the legal and violent forms of coercion that were added to the exploitation of the workplace, and that white workers, despite their exploitation, had been granted certain privileges that made them think that they were above this other level of exploitation, and therefore weren't joining in solidarity with others in a movement that could challenge the collective enemy, which was the bosses.
Right.
And so they started to organize specifically on the question of race. They organized anti-lynching movements, armed defense against lynching. They led the defense of in the Scottsboro campaign of 9 young black men who were falsely accused of rape. They organized some of the first integrated social gatherings in northern cities, and they called for the self-determination of what they called the Negro Nation in the South, in the Black Belt, which was a way of, you know, that's something that gets ridiculed a lot because, you know, race is not a nation or something like that. Both of these categories are social constructs. Right. It's not like one of them is more obviously real than the other.
Right.
But the point of doing that was to connect the oppression of black people in the United States with a global revolution against colonialism. And so they put that issue front and center for a significant period. And unfortunately, as the Communist Party grew more and more conservative over the years, that was dropped. But they laid the groundwork, a large part of the groundwork, that would be utilized later on in the civil rights movement. So that legacy is fundamental. It stretches through the 20th century.
And even the way the civil rights movement is presented really emphasizes certain values and tendencies and strategies over others. And it's very whitewashed. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to look at the civil rights movement in a much longer perspective. It didn't just start with the Montgomery bus boycott. Because earlier than that, there was what the historian Jacqueline Dowd Hall calls a civil rights unionism. And that was about a kind of agenda that involved jobs for all, full employment, fair wages, housing justice, and things like that, alongside the demands to end legal segregation. And the figures like A. Philip Randolph, who was one of the major organizers of the 1963 March on Washington, were involved in this kind of thing since the 1940s. And then when you look at the classic kind of phase of the civil rights movement that we're all familiar with, the one that starts in 55 and basically goes until 65, it always had this kind of radical dimension of talking about poverty from the beginning. If you read the writings of Martin Luther King as early as the second half of the 50s, he's talking about this. He's talking about poverty. And he's also making the connection to the world outside of the United States. And a lot of people talk about how Martin Luther King, the last year of his life, April 4th, 1967 through April 4th, 1968, was really quite radical, because on April 4th, 1967, he gave a speech against the Vietnam War in which he said that there were the three evils of American society, which were militarism, capitalism, and racism. And
up here at Riverside Church in
Manhattan. Yeah, exactly. And at that point, he was involved in organizing the Poor People's Campaign. And when he was shot, he was in Memphis trying to support the strike of sanitation workers. And he really was, that really came to the forefront in the last year of his life. But it was always there in varying ways. And, you know, he was, as his learning process continued, as he was involved in activism and learning from the new kinds of political events of the period. But right at the beginning, he made the connection to the Indian independence movement with Gandhi. And everybody knows that he gets the philosophy of nonviolence from Gandhi, but it's also a way of connecting the struggle of black people in the United States to the struggle of Indians against British colonialism. He always had that awareness.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought of it. I just thought of the nonviolence aspect.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, there's the internationalist,
exactly,
anti-colonial aspect. Can you talk about your own identity and how it's changed, or how your understanding of your identity has changed over time?
Yeah, for that I have to quote the great theorist of identity, Stuart Hall, who said, "Identity is not about returning to your roots, R-O-O-T-S, but about coming to terms with your roots, R-O-U-T-E-S." And I think that's what identity is about. It's not a fixed thing. It's about all the different roots and movements that we have had over time. So I could go back and think about some of my ancestors who migrated from Iran over into India, and then...
How long ago are we talking about?
Centuries. Okay. And then more recently, of the of my family who migrated from India to Pakistan after the partition, and then of my parents migrating from Pakistan to rural Pennsylvania.
Typical trajectory.
Yeah. So it's that kind of movement across entirely different contexts, and at every step involving mixing and mingling and changing. That's the kind of thing that constitutes our identities. And what I think is so, the reason I'm really cautious about retaining the word identity is that it doesn't get taken, it doesn't get understood in terms of this dynamic kind of process of movement and transformation. It gets understood as a fixed, stable thing. My essence, what's really inside me. And that hides this kind of movement, which I think is really constitutive of who we are.
It's interesting, though, because you talk about how your identity was either, I don't know if it was changed, the way you saw it was changed, the way other people saw it was changed on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I understand what you're saying about identity being this kind of false construct of a permanent thing, and it's not dynamic, but you also recognize that the way you are seen, right, is not fully up to you, right? Mm-hmm. You're walking down the street, you're seen a certain way. So how do you balance both acknowledging the way that affects your life with looking at identity in the way that you really see it, which is not the way that it's used as a term?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's part of that kind of fixing of identity, which is that after 9/11, you know, people looked at me and thought, like, there's, like, a Muslim, and that's, like, a threat to homeland security, and everything got kind of, like, reduced to that. All the other things, you know, it didn't matter that I was, like, into punk music or drank alcohol or ate bacon.
Right.
It just got fixed in terms of the specific political context. I think that defending people from that kind of racist imposition of identity doesn't have to mean accepting that kind of fixed idea of identity.
Did it create a sense of solidarity, though, for you between someone like you, a secular punk music listening to bacon consuming person, and someone who is religious and Muslim? Given that the world, in other words, you know, how after 9/11, right, there were attacks on Sikhs.
Yeah.
Or on Hindus.
Yeah.
And of
yeah.
course, you know, who have, not that it would be okay to attack a Muslim, but even within their racist view, it was just off. You know, even within the racist project, it wasn't the right demographic.
Yes, that's right. That was common then, yes.
Which, does that create an identity too? Like when you're subjected to the same things, even though you're different, does that create some kind of solidarity, cohesion?
It can, yeah, though, I mean, I never really got interested in religion.
Right, so. No, right. It didn't.
But, yeah, but as you point out, the people from completely different religions got associated with, like, the Islamic threat, even though, I mean, in India, obviously, they're, like,
if
really
only they
big,
confused those two
yeah.
groups, right?
So, but for me, it was more about solidarity with the tradition in the United States of fighting racism. That's when that really became meaningful to me, and that was something that was largely part of the Black Liberation Movement, and that really was meaningful to me in that context. And one figure who I think I connected with at the level of my Islamic background, the background of Islamic culture, was Malcolm X. You know. Because he was a part of the Black liberation struggle, and for him, Islam became a way of, this was at the end of his life, though there are traces of it before, Islam became a way of connecting with the Arab world and with, once again, making that internationalist kind of politics.
Did 9/11 politicize you? Were you already political and politicized in the way that you are right now, or?
I was sort of politicized just by going back and forth between the United States and Pakistan and seeing just the scale of inequality of wealth that exists in the world and the level of poverty that existed there alongside globally a level of wealth that would make it possible to eradicate poverty.
Right.
And that's what that was the basic underlying idea for me getting politicized. But then 9/11 really, I sort of really got thrown into it just because it was clear how narrow the understanding of politics was of the people around me who got swept up in kind of patriotism and were really ready to get on board with the war on terror. And I knew that there's like a whole rest of the world out there where people don't see it that way, where people even think of the United States as a terrorist kind of entity.
Right.
And so That really made me dive in, and I read all the Chomsky I could find in the bookstore. That was a time when you had to go to the bookstore to find this stuff, and like they have like two books by Chomsky, and so I read what I could.
Can you talk a little bit more about how the way identity politics is used today is diametrically opposed to the way identity politics was intended to, the purpose identity politics was intended to serve by the people who started using that. So not just in the theory, but in the real world and in practice.
Yeah, well, one thing is that identities get separated and get represented as having their own separate and irreconcilable interests. And so you lose the idea that there can be a politics which is about everybody's emancipation. And you lose the idea that there's a way that everyone can get involved. And one thing that you encounter, especially if you're an activist, you're part of organizing scenarios, they could be, you know, a range of things. One thing you encounter is the idea that only certain people who are in the most marginal positions should speak or have a right to speak about the issue that supposedly is completely manifested by their identity. You get the kind of logic of the laundry list, which, you know, when people use the word intersectionality now, it's also kind of been turned upside down, because it's instead of being a way of recognizing that intersectionality comes out of legal studies. And so it's, and Kimberly Crenshaw proposed this, that if you have an anti-discrimination lawsuit in which someone says, well, I was discriminated against because I'm a black woman, then the judge responds, well, you have to pick.
Right.
Either you were discriminated against because you're black, or you're discriminated against because you're a woman. So intersectionality is the idea of saying, no, there's an intersection of these things, and you have to describe the
whole
thing.
You really can't have it all, women. Lean in.
Right. But now when people talk about intersectionality, it's more about making the laundry list, which is to say, like, you know, as a, and I'm not going to list the things because then it will come off as offensive,
yeah.
But you list.
You could do your own stuff.
As my own stuff. As a bacon-eating Muslim, South Asian, heavy metal interested person,
right.
I don't think that this movement speaks for me, so I think that we should... we should have it split up.
I don't think this bacon tastes very good.
Yeah, well, that's rare. That's a rare...
No pun intended.
Yeah, there you go.
Wow, that was a beautiful moment. Yeah. Who would have thunk it? So the idea is that your politics are just informed by your identity,
exactly.
Right? So you can only speak about something if you're a member of the group that's being affected, which...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that means you can't have coalitions the way that the Combahee River Collective did. And so they, when you read these recent interviews that Kianga Yamada Taylor did with them, they're really clear about this. They say, like, we never wanted this to be a way of just saying we only work on stuff that's related to me, and if you're
right.
not like me, I don't want to be involved with you. And unfortunately, that's something that happens really often now, and under the name of identity politics.
Yeah, and there's a real emphasis on the individual over mm-hmm. the collective or the universal. And you talk about universality.
Yeah.
But that's something I think we really see, where people's kind of individual identities are the canvas upon which identity politics is painted. I had to finish that metaphor. I'm looking for the place where you talk. It's a really great quote about the individual. Oh, yes. You write you write about Huey P. Newton, and you say, but what mattered the most to me was that Newton did not stop with his own identity. His experience led him beyond himself to take up a politics based on solidarity with Cuba, China, Palestine, and Vietnam. His example corroborated the Communist Manifesto, the vast poverty I had witnessed in Pakistan, and the long history of racial oppression that echoed into present-day Pennsylvania went hand in hand. Any solution would have to confront them both. The insights of this brilliant thinker, Karl Marx, did not belong to Europe. They belonged to the whole world, to everyone who fought against injustice. They had been refined and developed in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, even here in the belly of the beast, amid the acid and bile of patriotism and evangelicism. Is that it? Yeah. Black Americans had shown that this legacy could not be geographically confined. This paragraph makes two really important points. One is that there's a, you know, individual liberation is not as, can be just an individual liberation. It's not necessarily political. And in fact, the focus on individual liberation can take away from a more universal political project. And also the idea that there's something very infantilizing and fetishizing about the idea that, you know, Marx and Marxism is the realm of white men. And it's very essentializing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't resonate with people of color. I mean, first of all, look at Castro and look at Mao,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But those are two ideas that I think have really permeated politics.
Yeah,
since 2016, especially.
When a politics around race and gender becomes reduced to individuals, that means it becomes about the advancement of individuals, sort of in the American dream of social mobility. And that is not a politics which is about overcoming the whatever kind of oppression is experienced by the majority of people who fall under whatever identity category this social climber has. And so what you get is elite figures who claim that they're fighting against racism or fighting against sexism, when actually what they're doing is only in the interest of a very small minority of people who have gained entry into the wealthiest and most powerful minority of the population.
Right. And it further legitimizes that system, right, by suggesting that, look, we can overcome these barriers. But
and they claim, look, we're continuing the legacy. We're continuing what the civil rights movement
right.
accomplished, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you're really not, because you're really leaving behind most of the people that the civil rights movement and any other liberation movement was trying to fight for.
Right, like the Poor People's
exactly.
Campaign.
Exactly.
Which they're reviving now
mm-hmm.
with
yeah.
Reverend William Barber.
Barber, yeah, yeah.
Who I'd love to have on the show, if you're watching. There's this other really scary idea. Oh, sorry, before we go there, can you talk about, in terms of erasure, you have this irony where people who claim to really respect identity and identity politics, they also engage in quite a bit of erasure. In fact, I think, how long have you been white, according to these people?
I've been white since, I'm often converted into white in particular social situations in which white people have assumed that anyone associating with them must be white, because whiteness is like the basic minimum requirement for entry into the club. And that's weird. And it always reminds me of the comment, which I quote, of Joe Biden about Obama, this gaffe he made. He said,
one of his many gaffes.
Yeah. That Obama's so clean and articulate,
right?
And so this is like what white people tend to think.
To be fair to Joe Biden, he's very equal opportunity in his offensive gaffes. You know, he
yeah.
covers all demographics, so
yeah.
shout out to him for that. Yeah.
Right. But I think really there was something much more drastic that happened with the 2016 primaries, which was because of the polarization between... and I'm talking like now about like a kind of ideological polarization. I'm not talking about policies and all kinds of details that people could quibble about, but the ideological polarization between the Sanders and Clinton kind of platforms was one in which it was assumed that if you support the kind of efforts against economic inequality that Sanders really represented, that you had to be a white Bernie bro, right? And I was not heavily involved in the Bernie campaign. I thought it was a real step forward because it introduced a lot of young people to a different way of thinking about politics, and it mobilized a lot of people to kind of change the political discourse and change the structure that we have in our two-party system.
And criticize capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that was a real step forward. And the Democratic Party elite figured out a really effective way to suppress that. And that way was to say that if you align yourself with this in any way, you are a white Bernie bro, and you are ignoring problems of race and gender.
Right. You're not centering women, people of color, LGBTQ people, as if economic exploitation isn't, like you were saying in the beginning, with overlapping identities and intersectionalism and the impossibility of separating class and race. Like, if you understand how racism works, you get that economics exploitation is that much worse for people of color.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is where racism shows up.
Yes.
A lot is in class.
Yes. And that's what happens when you shift the perspective away from the individual and individual advancement, and then you realize that there are very large populations of people of color whose most pressing needs have to do with restoring public works, with overcoming precarity of labor, with overcoming extremely low wages, with getting access to health care.
Right.
These are issues that really matter for people of color.
Right. So universal programs, ironically, are the most disproportionately affect people of color, right? So the Fight for 15, that's mostly women and people of color.
Yeah.
So when people try to present that as kind of privileging economics over race, it doesn't even do that. Like, regardless of your feelings about that or your thoughts about that, it doesn't even function that way.
Yeah.
So if you care about addressing problems, forget strategy for a second and organizing and coalitions, but if you actually want these problems to be addressed, you want to support these universal programs.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, we have to say that strategy matters in the sense that you have to make sure that your messaging is getting that out. And so if you have white socialists and so on who are tone deaf to these things and who don't try to highlight the tradition that we've had in the United States of people of color fighting for economic equality, that's a real error.
Yeah.
Because you have to be able to fight against this attempt to suppress.
Right. You're walking into their trap.
Policy.
You're
exactly.
Like doing their work for them.
Exactly.
But also on the other side of it, you have strategy in terms of when you have universal programs, you are able to bring in people who may have resentments and racist resentments, right? You also make the programs that much less vulnerable to being cut. You know, I always think of like how Newt Gingrich didn't talk about Social Security queens, although he wanted to cut it. He talked about welfare queens. And it's a way to, again, all these people who use identity politics as a term, really, in theory, want to defeat Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And how do you think you do that?
Yeah.
It's like this refusal to deal with deplorables or undesirables is so counterproductive, even if you don't care about these people. You could think that, you know, white workers are the wretched of the earth. You could have no sympathy. You could have all sorts of classist, ideas about them. You still, in theory, want them to vote for the non-Trump person.
Yeah. And the thing is, a lot of them don't vote. And the white people who voted for Trump often were people who had higher incomes. It's a real fallacy that we've had in this country that working class people who are white have inherently conservative politics. I mean, historically, they've tended to vote for Democrats, and rich people historically have tended to vote for Republicans. It gets muddled in the South.
Right.
It gets muddled in places where there's still the legacy of legal segregation and where the poverty of the whole state sort of scrambles the political terms. But there's a diverse working class. There's a highly diverse working class which is disaffected because they think politics don't represent them. Politicians don't represent them. And if you want to defeat Trump, you have to reach the whole range of them.
Right.
That means a whole range of programs that deal with their immediate needs.
Right. And there is this weird false dichotomy as if doing something that's universal somehow throws certain communities under the bus.
Yeah.
And it's the opposite.
Yeah,
And it's a way of kind of preventing division and stigmatization, right? You no longer see people as receiving special treatment.
Right.
What programs, by the way, do you think any programs that are racially targeted or ethnically targeted or gender targeted, whatever the term is, are any of those necessary? Are there any things that class more universal based programs don't address?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, I don't think in terms of policy. I think in terms of movements. Mm. And I think, you know, for example, when you've got a union movement, when you've got a labor movement and you've got a union at a particular workplace, it has to take up problems of discrimination that are racial and sexual.
Right.
You know, the union's role is to represent the people who are being not only exploited but also discriminated against. And so that's about having a broad perspective and I think in terms of movements in that way.
Focus, yeah. or orientations, but not policy per se.
Yeah.
But right, so a perfect example is sexual harassment,
yeah,
in the labor movement, right? That's one,
yeah,
of the, Alex Press, I've interviewed her about this and spoken to her about it, and one of the biggest, most pressing issues for lots of workers is harassment that they,
yes,
face.
Yes.
So you can't really, if you want to have a real, you know, strong labor movement, you can't present those issues as being on the sidelines or unrelated to class.
Yeah, I mean, as early as the 19th century, the late 19th century, when you started to get a lot of unions that were, a lot of them were connected to the socialist movement in Germany, and you can read about this in one of the Viewpoint issues, the Viewpoint issue 5, in which my co-editor and I wrote an introduction in which we talk about this. Even in this classical kind of period of socialism and the rise of trade unions, that you had unions like the Union of Textile Workers, who were mostly women.
Right.
And they were constantly going on strike against harassment by the manager. And it wasn't, I mean, there was no conception that that's different. So, like, they went on strike so that when a worker got pregnant, she didn't have to keep coming in. I mean,
oh, yeah,
those they actually saw those as economic demands,
right.
And they're also anti-discrimination,
yeah, of course,
demands.
Right, yeah,
yeah.
So fascinating. Or like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, right,
yeah,
which happened here, where majority, I mean, it was almost all women, largely,
yeah,
immigrant, and they didn't have, they were locked into this factory, and there's a fire, and
this is a big misconception, yeah, by the way, about Karl Marx's Capital. The book Capital has a lot of...
real beach read, by the way. Page turner.
It has a lot of kind of accounts of the class struggles in factories. And most of those workers in this period are women and children. And so he's actually talking about women.
So you're saying one of the myths is that he wasn't speaking to,
yeah,
the experiences or realities of women and children.
Exactly. That just doesn't correspond to what,
right,
was actually happening in Industrial Revolution England, which he was describing.
And he also, I mean, so right, so there's an inherent gender aspect to the labor discussion, but he also talked about things like the family and you know, marriage,
yeah, especially
legalized
Engels
prostitution.
Did. Yeah.
Yeah, Engels, yeah, his,
yeah,
sugar daddy.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
There's also this weird thing, there's this really weird takeaway, which is that because there are racists and because white people can be seduced by racism, therefore class-based organizing will not work. And it's like, wait, don't you get it? It's the exact opposite. It's in a vacuum. Like, that's why we need to have class-based organizing, because if you don't have it on that, what else do people have to grab onto?
Yeah.
It competes directly with it.
Well, so the first part of it is that you need to make another political language available, another way of thinking about politics available that isn't right-wing populism.
Right.
But then the other thing that you have to do is you have to start to re-educate some white people who just don't get it.
Right.
And sometimes people who are socialists and who are involved in, you know, Bernie-type campaigns forget that part.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that part, then people aren't going to listen. I mean, if you have to be able to demonstrate that you are working on these issues, because they're not separate.
Yeah. And there is a weird empathy that, like, is there's a lot of empathy among the left, or even with liberals, there's a lot of empathy, but it kind of ends with class. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're, and I hate saying this because it sounds like I'm being a self-pitying white person, but I have very little in common. If anything, I'm like a snob, honestly, if I'm going to check my privilege. I have very little in common with a coal miner in Kentucky, right?
Yeah.
But, like, there is a lack of empathy towards that person compared to the empathy that we'll see among people towards, let's say, a person of color who is homophobic. And I'm not comparing racism, so a racist coal miner and, let's say, a homophobic black person in the Northeast. Like, I'm not equating those two things, but it is interesting how people have this understanding of access and education and consciousness raising that kind of stops when we're talking about white working class people.
Well, I think there's a phenomenon which I find really disgusting, which is of white liberals who are totally woke on questions of race and gender and then are just completely contemptuous and will, use every stereotype about what they think are rednecks and hicks
and how they deserve to lose their health care.
Yeah.
If they voted for Trump, right?
Yeah. And you know, most of them didn't vote for Trump.
Sure, right. And even the ones, I mean, the irony again is, like, you can have contempt for them. It's not a strategic move to further alienate these people.
Yeah.
And again, with messaging, with anti-racist messaging and universal programs, you reach everyone.
Yeah. And a lot of those people, you know, are on strike right now.
Right.
And they've been, and that, those are transformative experiences. Those change the way people think about politics. That's the time when you can make coalitions. You can start to see people crossing boundaries. And so that's another thing. I said I think in terms of movements rather than policy. When you have a movement and you are really dedicated to overcoming racial division in the movement, and you're working, and you come up with a demand or a program that is in the interests of a broad range of people, people learn to work together.
Right.
People learn to understand things from other perspectives.
And the common shared goals.
Yes.
It's like people will often point to the racist practices or the exclusion of the labor movement, which existed, but we also have examples of really inspiring multiracial organizing from the labor movement.
Exactly.
But people don't point to that because that doesn't support their thesis that you can't actually use economic kind of campaigns or justice or movements to reach across barriers.
And part of that is because these days people barely know what a labor movement is. I mean, such low rates of unionization, propaganda that's been like a century of propaganda against the very idea of having a union has been very successful. And so that's part of why people don't know that this is an option, that a union can struggle for racial equality.
Right. What about being told you're white on Twitter? You have a twin brother named Shuja Hader, friend of the show, the Katie Halper Show, got to get you on Young Turks. And he is constantly being told he's white. He's a twin of yours, so I'm not sure if you guys get the same white diagnosis at the same rates since you're twins, but...
Well, I get it less because I spend less time on Twitter,
right,
which, you know, I try to influence him to do as well.
Shuja, this is an intervention.
Yeah, but...
And Shuja's a great writer and writes about similar things and also music, too.
Yeah. That phenomenon is hard to explain. I mean, if it's just a cynical ploy to discredit us, it's a pretty stupid one because we're obviously not white.
Yeah.
We have Muslim names and so on. If it's not a
and
cynical
you're not like
ploy,
Chechen, you know, Muslims or whatever.
If it's not a cynical ploy, it's like a level of delusion that I can't, you know, I can't really grasp. I don't know. People are getting so swept up in their in trying. I mean, maybe the explanation is that white people get so devoted to displaying how woke they are and how
allyship.
Engaged they are in allyship and identity politics that they totally forget. They lose their minds for a minute, and they're like, you know, you're just another one of these white people who doesn't care, and they don't even stop to check.
Right. Yeah.
Know?
hey, Assad hater, you're yeah, a terrible white wasp or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's come out of the closet here for a second. I was actually thinking about, well, is this good for the Young Turks audience? And then I realized, you know, there's a lot of anti-capitalism out there. It's pretty exciting. We even had Hillary Clinton last week, speaking at the Shared Value Leadership Summit in New York City. And she was having a chat with Time Inc. brand CCO Alan Murray, who asked her if her identifying as a capitalist hurt her. And she said, probably. It's hard to know, but I mean, if you're in the Iowa caucuses and 41% of Democrats are socialists or self-described socialists, and I'm asked, are you a capitalist? And I say, yes, but with appropriate regulation and appropriate accountability, you know, that probably gets lost in the, oh my gosh, she's a capitalist. And there are these, you know, a Gallup poll conducted in 2016 found that 55% of Americans under 30 have a positive view of socialism. A Harvard University study found that 51% of U.S. adults under the age of 30 do not support capitalism. So I think maybe we're ready to talk about Marxism.
Yeah, and I'll add another interesting poll, and I don't remember when this was, but it was a poll about knowledge that American citizens have about the U.S. Constitution, and something like half of the people polled thought that the phrase "from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs" was in the U.S. Constitution. Of course, it's an old socialist slogan that was used famously by Marx in his critique of the Gotha program.
What program?
The critique of the Gotha program.
What's that?
He took a program that was written by another socialist organization, and he scribbled in the margins all of his objections to everything they did, and then he put it in his drawer, and he just said, okay, I'm not going to cause any trouble. It was published later by Engels.
Okay, but that's Gotha, like Goethe, like the German?
No, G-O-T-H-A.
No, okay, got it, yeah. So can you tell us, your magazine Viewpoint is identifies as Marxist.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit, by the way, happy belated birthday.
To Marx?
To Marx.
May 5th,
he would have been 200 had his life not been cut short a century ago.
Yes.
By aging. How did you celebrate?
I celebrated by participating in an amazing initiative that's happening in Seattle called Red May, and this is the second year they've done it. I was there the first year as well, and they had this awesome Karl Marx birthday cake with a picture of him and with some of the
Was it vegan?
There was a second vegan cake which had the expanded formula for capital on
nice.
It. Yeah. So that was the celebration, and everybody should take a look at what they're doing in Seattle, Red May. It's a whole month of Marxist and socialist events, and it's amazing that they pulled it off, a second time. Next year is the anniversary of the Seattle General Strike of 1919, so I expect a lot from them next year.
Yeah, they really raised the bar.
Yeah.
So wait, was the size of the slice of cake dependent on each person's hunger?
And each person's needs.
Yeah, like caloric intake?
It was evenly divided and then distributed to those who wanted cake, basically.
Oh,
and,
so it's universal. It's not needs-based.
But not everybody opted into cake.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
I'm afraid I did.
That's good. No, you got to normalize it.
Yeah.
Or else cake could be slashed.
People could try
to get rid of cake.
That's right.
And so what does being a Marxist mean today?
Yeah, well, what I think Marxism means, and what I think Karl Marx's contribution was, is to present an analysis of what he called the capitalist mode of production and of its contradictions. And he showed that the capitalist mode of production, even when it's in a society in which people have rights and they're formally equal and so we have a constitution and so on, even in that context, the workplace is the site of total tyranny over the workers, and it's the site of exploitation. Even if everybody is allowed to own their own commodities and sell them in the market, you know, that's the kind of vision that now gets called neoliberalism, which comes from figures like Hayek and von Mises, the idea that everybody is an entrepreneur. And that's a big part of the American ideology, that we're all entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
But actually, most of us work for a wage, and we work for bosses, And we don't own the things we need to survive. We have to depend on the market to get them. And so we need to work for a wage in order to live. That's the basic structure of capitalism, and it's a tyrannical one, and it's an exploitative one. And so Marx presented an analysis of that. He presented an analysis of why it's constantly going into crisis, and you know, people find themselves unemployed, businesses go under. This is, you know, why there are all these think pieces about Marx after the 2008 crisis, where everyone was like, hey, wait, this guy was predicting that these crises were going to happen. But then the next important thing about Marx is that he thought that it was possible for working people to unite and overthrow this system. And that's what Marxism is, and that's why it hasn't lost its relevance today.
Lots of people say, oh, he was wrong, because look, we don't have international communism.
Yeah.
Lots of people say he's, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal,
mm-hmm.
And it was, Marx's apologist should be red in the face, very funny.
Mm.
The bicentennial of the man whose ideas killed untold millions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea that Marx was both ineffective,
yeah.
And not a good, not very prescient, and not very, didn't predict things well, and also
right.
caused the death of a lot of people. So it's kind of a lose-lose.
Okay. So two things. First of all, yeah, he was wrong about the tenacity of capitalism. He kept thinking every time there was a crisis, okay, this is it.
Right.
The revolution's going to happen. Eventually, he became a little more sanguine about that. But and Capital, his masterwork, you know, Capital Volume 1, which is the only volume he published in his lifetime.
Like History of the World Part 1 by Mel Brooks.
Yeah, exactly.
The only one exists.
The only one. There are two other volumes that Engels put together. But he wasn't as optimistic about the destruction of capitalism that, but he still was a little bit. There's
right.
one chapter in which he suggests, "Hey, this is just going to happen," but he was aware it's not just going to happen. You know, it isn't just like the whole process of history is just going to inevitably
right.
result in revolution. So he sometimes believed that, and sometimes you know. In the socialist movement, in the labor movement, which were often identical, they were often the same thing, it was a useful kind of thing to say, hey, history's on our side.
Yeah.
This system can't last.
Boosting. Yeah.
So that's kind of why that kind of prediction was often there. But capitalism has lasted longer. It's changed in various ways. And Marxists have to take account of that and have to study that. The other part about he's responsible for so many debts. It's just a silly claim because, first of all, I mean, let's think about the actual revolutions that happened in the 20th century. The first thing we have to note about them is that they overthrew centuries-old forms of oppression. Tsarism in Russia and colonialism in China, Vietnam, Latin America, Africa. These were all movements that took up Marxism as their theory of liberation, and they overthrew systems that had resulted in a scale of death that we can barely even count now.
Actually, nobody ever died. They were all immortal
right.
before communism,
right.
before Karl
yeah.
Marx's ideology. Yeah.
But people, I mean, this is a scale of death people barely even count. And you know, actually, there's, you know, the economist Amartya Sen, he did a comparative
yeah.
study of the famines of the Great Leap Forward in China, you know, which was Mao's program in the 50s, and he compared it to India, and he said, like, look, a lot of people died in the Great Leap Forward. It was disastrous, but something like every 8 years, the same
wow.
number of people die in India just because of the poverty that happens from capitalism.
Without communism.
Yeah. yeah.
Right. And he's not just talking about Kerala, I assume.
No.
Little communist.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other thing to note is that while these revolutions were successful in overthrowing old forms of oppression, they were not successful in establishing new socialist societies. They tried, in many cases they got themselves into a lot of trouble. They weren't able to figure out how to, basically the core problem was, once you overthrow the existing state, what do you do? How do you now, like, build a society? How do you now take over the functions that the previous state had? And in most cases, the only institution they had to take over was the Communist Party. And the party often had, because it existed in conditions of total state repression, civil war, colonization, they often had really rigid hierarchical structures. And they were accustomed to dealing with things through methods of violence because that's the environment that they emerged in. So that's kind of, that's my analysis of why these societies were authoritarian and weren't able to establish a new kind of society that they had hoped for.
And you don't have to be communist to be authoritarian, right? We have tons of
not at all
governments
not at all.
And movements and ideologies that are authoritarian and not communist.
Yes.
So wanted to know if you could define some terms.
Oh, yeah.
Could call this section Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Leftism, But We're Afraid to Ask.
Okay.
Neoliberalism, that's one that people really want to know about.
Oh, okay. I mean, neoliberalism is a response to the fact that the existing system of capitalism that existed from after the Great Depression up through the 1970s went into crisis. And that was a particular period in the history of capitalism in which there was an unprecedented level of prosperity and there were very strong labor movements. And so labor was able to demand a bigger share of an increasing pie. And part of the prosperity of this period was the result of Keynesian policies, in which the state state really regulated industry, made big investments in public works programs, and there was a kind of a compact, kind of an agreement between management and labor to in the service of development.
So worker, okay. Like the middle class had more money and then they would spend more money, invest in the economy.
Yeah, and you had a rising standard of living, okay? And so that was a short period in the history of capitalism. There's no like typical way that capitalism operates. In Industrial Revolution England, when Marx was writing, it was totally different. And then during the Depression, it was totally different. But this period entered into crisis in the 1970s. There are all kinds of reasons why. Part of it has to do with international competition, the emergence of Japan and Germany as new competitors for the United States. So neoliberalism was the response in which there was an effort to completely destroy and smash the power of organized labor and fragment the working class.
Thank you so much again, Asad, for coming on the show. I just want to let people know about two events that are happening. One is on May 10th. That is at McNally Jackson for our New York City viewers or New Jersey Tri-State Area viewers. McNally Jackson, the bookstore. And then on May 15th. And then on May 15th, there's an event at Verso Books in Brooklyn, and I'll be part of that. So if you got to choose between those two, I think you know which one you got to choose. Thanks so much, TYT viewers, for watching. I'm Katie Halper.